The Google Podcast app is going away in April. Right now, I want you to take a look at the podcast app you're using right now. Maybe it's time for a new one. Check out podcastapps.com and try a new one for free right now. That's podcastapps.com.
My name is David Adams Richards. I'm a writer and a senator from Canada, and I'm ready to go digging deep.
I'm Mark Sutcliffe. And I'm on a quest to learn from the best. Welcome to Digging Deep, presented by Zen Books and Abacus Data. This is the latest in our series of one-on-one conversations with thoughtful, thought-provoking, interesting, fascinating, accomplished people in many different fields. On this episode, prolific author, storyteller, and Canadian senator, David Adams Richards. So, a few years ago, David Adams Richards was traveling on a highway in New Brunswick when he stopped and picked up a hitchhiker. They got talking, and the man told him he had just been released from jail. And they continued chatting, and the man revealed that he was on his way home to kill a member of his family. Now, that's a true story. It's not a fictional tale from one of Richards' novels. And yet, it is just the kind of internal battle and moral dilemma that Richards has been writing about for years. When he was a teenager, Richards read Oliver Twist, and it changed the course of his life. He decided he wanted to become a writer. And it was not an easy path. It was certainly not lucrative for a very long time. He had to sell almost everything he owned in order to keep writing. But in the end, it launched him toward an award-winning career publishing novels, short stories, poetry, plays, screenplays, and essays. He finished his first novel before he turned 20. His latest novel is called Darkness. Richards has based much of his writing around themes of morality and religion, courage, integrity, and human nature. Much of his work has been set in the Miramichi region in New Brunswick, where he comes from. And he tells the stories of poor and working class people who live there. He's one of only three writers to have received a Governor General's Award for both fiction and nonfiction. He has won two Gemini Awards for script writing, and he won the Giller Prize. And in 2009, Richards was made a member of the Order of Canada. And then, in a bit of a plot twist, in 2017, David Adams Richards was appointed to the Senate of Canada. We will hear the story of why he decided to apply for the Senate and how he has brought a lifetime of experience to his role as a senator. This is really an emotional, gripping, inspiring, fascinating, wide-ranging conversation with a consummate storyteller. We are going to talk about David Adams Richards' childhood in New Brunswick, about his incredible grandmother fighting fiercely to keep the movie theater that she operated, about the time David threw a book at his teacher, about the difference between moral courage and physical courage, why our battles are almost always internal, choosing between good and evil, and forgiveness. We will also hear about some of Richard's favorite books to read, the ones that made a huge impression on him, and why you don't say no to the Queen. And of course, he will share with us the story of the hitchhiker that he picked up on the highway. All right, one last thing before we get started. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to our podcast and post a review of Digging Deep on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, and share this podcast with your network. And if you're looking for more information or you want to listen to other episodes, please go to letsdigdeep.com. That's letsdigdeep.com. Now, let's start digging deep with the highly accomplished author and Canadian senator, David Adams Richards. David, it is such a pleasure to welcome you. And I'm very curious to hear about your writing life and about what you have learned since you became a senator in Canada You have this sort of fascinating world. You have a long history in your home province of New Brunswick that I hope we can get into. So welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with our questions to get to know you a little bit better. What would you say is your fondest childhood memory?
Fishing, going trout fishing. First time I went trout fishing, I was 4 years old. Loved it ever since.
Wow. And you've been doing it ever since?
Well, except for the last few years, I've kind of slowed down. But yeah, for years and years, I was a passionate salmon and trout fisherman, yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And who was your hero when you were 10 years old?
Rocket Richard.
Rocket Richard, wow.
Yeah. When I was 10, he retired. It was devastating to me that he retired, because I never thought a man like Rocket Richard would ever retire. Yeah. And then I'm a big Habs fan. So you know what that means in the last few days, don't you?
Yes. Yeah. As we're recording this, they're coming off a big win. So that must have been pretty exciting. I grew up a Montreal fan too. So what a great tradition. What did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
Well, I had no idea. My family thought I might be a lawyer until I was 14. I had no idea, but I read Oliver Twist when I was 14 and I decided that I was going to be a writer. And I never thought of anything else after that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back to why that story in particular had such an impact. What would you say is your life story in 6 words?
Well, I was lucky to be born. I'm still here. That's probably it.
Lucky to be born and still here. Yeah. I like it. Yeah. That's a tough question to ask somebody who's used to writing, 75,000 or 100,000 words. is there a big mistake in your life that you've learned from? Is there anything that you would share?
I started drinking when I was 14. Bad thing to do. Stop drinking when I was 32. Good thing to do.
Mm. And yeah. You've been off it ever since?
Yeah, I haven't had a drink since I was 32.
Okay, wow.
Yeah.
For what do you feel most grateful?
My children.
What has been the best year of your life so far and why?
Oh, I would have to say when my children were born, I suppose that would be the 89 and 95. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what's been the toughest year of your life so far?
Well, there was a year when we sold our 20-year-old car to pay the rent. And my wife had to go out selling Amway because she had no work. And I was writing my third or fourth book. And we had absolutely no money. So if I ever thought of quitting writing, that would have been the year. But we made it through.
You scraped through and
yeah,
were able mm-hmm. to get. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
What one person has had the greatest impact on your life?
Oh, I think my wife.
And why?
Well, she was with me through the bad times, and there was quite a few bad times. So, yeah. Yeah.
What's the most important lesson you've learned that you would share with other people?
Personal integrity can't be bought or sold. You have to have it in your soul. And I think that's a very important thing for individuals, because there's no life without personal integrity, no matter how many rules you try to follow. So, I mean, I think that's
What would people be most surprised to learn about you?
That I'm a bad golf player, that I cannot play golf, and I keep trying and trying and trying. And my son hits the ball a mile, and I take 4 shots to get up to where his shot is. So, but I keep thinking, you keep thinking that you're really going to par a hole, or you're going. And so, I mean, I think they'd be surprised that I would never give it up, being so bad at it. But right. I'll never give it up. No.
So you've never lost hope that you're
never lost hope.
A couple of rounds away from success.
A couple of rounds away from being Phil Mickelson, yeah.
Yeah. What is your secret talent? We know about your many of your talents, but what's your secret talent?
I play the mouth organ.
The mouth organ, okay.
Yeah, not very well, but I do play it, and it's secret because I don't play it in front of anyone.
Okay.
And I can do a few blues songs, but mainly I do a lot of Bobby Dylan songs, which is fun. Wow. Because the real trick is that I shouldn't say this, but Bobby's not the greatest mouth organ player in the world, although he certainly is passable. So you can learn his songs quicker than you can learn Sonny Boy Williamson songs, or you know, one of the great blues, or Little Richard, or Little Richard, you know what I mean. The blues is really difficult, but Bobby's songs are easy, so I tend to play those, yeah.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. What's the most fun that you've ever had?
Oh, God, running the river and fishing, I suppose. I know I sound like a broken record, but that's fun. And, of course, when I was younger, I curled a lot, and I had a good time curling in Bonsfield. And, of course, I thought, of course, that's another thing. I thought it'd be a bad gushu, and it never worked out.
Curling and golf.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I couldn't skate, you see. I could never skate because I was born with a lame left side. I was born too much premature, and my left side was damaged when I was born. My mother fell on her stomach and my head when she was hanging out the clothes, and I was born at 7 months, so I could never skate, but I loved hockey. I wrote a book about hockey called Hockey Dreams, and I loved hockey, but since I couldn't play hockey, I became a curler, and I wasn't a bad curler. I was pretty good, but no Brad Gushu or Kevin Martin or anything. But,
right. What is the scariest thing you've ever done?
One time I climbed the cliffs with my friend Giles Kenny, and he's like a mountain goat. And I found out halfway up that I'm no mountain goat. And I got stuck on a ledge about 30 feet off the ground, and I couldn't go forward. I couldn't go backward. That was pretty scary. He got me along it, and I managed to get up, and I never climbed that ledge again.
Yeah.
That was pretty scary. So I'll say that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, because I haven't done anything like mountain climbing, but I've climbed, you know, I've done hikes on some pretty steep hills in Europe and places like that. And it's sometimes scarier coming down than it is going up. Right.
The thing about it is I had to continue up on this certain cliff because we couldn't go back. But I climbed a mountain in Virginia with my friend Rick Trethaway and my wife. And you're right. It was more difficult coming down than going up. Now it wasn't a mountain. It was just a kind of a mound, but it was high enough. But you're right. It was harder coming down than going up.
What is your boldest prediction for the future?
Oh, God, I don't know. Yeah, the economy is going to turn around, and the pandemic is going to end, and we're all going to be wonderful. How's that?
That's pretty bold.
That's hoping, isn't it?
It's hopeful, yeah. It's actually interesting. Since, you know, this podcast began during the pandemic, and most of the people answer that question by saying something like some version of, we're all going to be okay. that's what counts as a bold prediction in the middle of the pandemic, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. If you were speaking to a group of students, what would be the message of your commencement address today?
That you have to remain yourself and not how others tell you you should be. Because there's a lot of, in this generation, and it's like the generation that I came out of the 60s, where mimicry is the great flaw. And it's terrible. You begin to lose part of yourself if you become a mimic, and there's so many ways to become one. Mimicry of false concern is a great danger in today's world too. So I would stress that, as I stress to my writing students, write what you know, not what other people tell you you should know. And I feel that way about being yourself, not what other people tell you you should be. I think that's the most difficult thing to achieve, actually.
Mm-hmm. You said mimicry of false concern. Can you expand on that?
Well, I think that mimicry, the false concern for the victim in order to gain political or economic or emotional power is a very dangerous thing in our society. And it's being used by politicians, and it's being used by ordinary people in day-to-day life. So you pick scapegoats that you blame for the troubles of the victim. And I think that can be very dangerous in our world because sometimes you pick the wrong victim. As a matter of fact, that's what Darkness, my last novel, is about. And I wrote that before I became a senator. I wrote that 5 years ago. but it still had the idea that mimicry of false concern destroys the lives of two or three people in the book. And so I've been concerned about this for quite a while.
Yeah, and I want to come back to that theme of scapegoats. What's been a recent epiphany for you? Is there something that you've discovered recently or something about which you've changed your mind?
No, it's a terrible thing to say, and I know that I must sound like a terrible old conservative fogey, but I haven't really changed my mind on many issues since I was 21 or 22.
Wow.
I've written about the effects of individuality and the loss of individual spirit since I was writing Blood Ties or Coming to Winter. And now I think I've matured in my work and handled it from different positions and perhaps with deeper understanding, but I think that's what I've mainly dealt with in my certainly in my later fiction, but I think in a way in my earlier fiction too. And also that family life is of primary importance to the human soul. What is so devastating about the 60s scoop of the First Nations played in the last century is that their family life was taken away from them. Yeah. And so the spirit of the family was taken away because of that. So, I mean, those are devastating things. And family life is I think, plays a huge part in the overall construction of my fiction. So.
Hmm. You obviously have written many books yourself. Aside from the ones you've written, what book are you most likely to recommend to other people? Do you have a favorite?
Well, there might be a couple. Sure. I thought of this, and I would have to recommend War and Peace by Tolstoy. Now, it's only 1,500 pages, and people should be able to read it in a day or two. I gave it to one young lady who I was fond of once, and she gave it back in a week. She said she loved it. She skipped all the battles. She just read about the family. She just read about the peace, not the war.
Right.
But it is just such a towering, magnificent book. And almost any book by Dostoevsky. His third book, The Devils, with the added chapter that his wife and editor told him to take out. And he took it out initially, and because he did, the book doesn't make sense. You do not know why Strev Goen is so frantic and so self-destructive. When the chapter is included, you realize, but because it was such a devastating chapter, they convinced him to take it out. So now it's been reintroduced. Hmm. So I would read that, and I would read Crime and Punishment. I think Crime and Punishment is one of the phenomenal novels of the last two centuries. But I mean, there's a lot more too. There's a lot more now. There's a lot more books I could mention.
Hmm. Okay. Thank you for answering those questions. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll continue digging deep with David Adams Richards. We're just going to take a quick break so I can tell you a little bit more about the presenting sponsor of Digging Deep, Zen Books. ZenBooks is Canada's go-to cloud accounting firm. They are not your typical accounting firm. I know the founders, Colin and Eric. I've worked with them for several years. And here's why I think you should consider working with them too. First of all, they bring a fresh, unique, modern approach to what is a very old-fashioned industry. These guys were working remotely and in the cloud long before it became cool. ZenBooks also uses technology to your advantage. I think this is really important. They give you the tools and analysis you need to monitor your business in real time. That's so valuable right now when everything changes so quickly. Yes, they're a virtual accounting firm, but that doesn't mean they're offshore, and it doesn't mean they're inattentive. ZenBooks combines the efficiency and effectiveness of a cloud accounting service with all the benefits that you'd want from a trusted advisor, high-level advice, and strategic support. Now, here's what I think is going to happen if you work with ZenBooks. You'll probably start out taking advantage of their cutting-edge cloud accounting solutions, but in the long run, I think you'll stay with them because of their strategic guidance and problem solving. Among their core values, they specifically list being candid and proactive. Isn't that exactly what you want from a trusted advisor? Look, even if you're already working with an accountant or a bookkeeper, or you have some accounting staff on your team, I think you should still talk to ZenBooks and learn more about their tools and their expertise. Check out ZenBooks at zenbooks.ca. That's zenbooks.ca. Digging Deep is all about helping you make better decisions, and so is Abacus Data. Most leaders struggle to connect with and engage their audiences. Why is that? It's because they aren't sure how they think and feel and how they will react. Abacus Data can give you the strategic insights you need to make better decisions and to make them confidently. Here's a good example. A major national union was recently negotiating a new agreement for its thousands of members. This had the potential to be a very difficult process. There were many competing interests. So they brought in Abacus Data to conduct thorough and detailed research of their members to learn exactly where they stood, what they were thinking, what they wanted. And as a result, they were able to secure a strong new deal that was accepted overwhelmingly in a national vote. Abacus Data helps all of its clients understand what's really happening in the minds of their employees, clients, and stakeholders. They help them avoid costly blind spots. And they're really good at what they do. In fact, Abacus Data was one of the most accurate pollsters in the 2019 Canadian federal election. Make the one decision that will improve all of your other decisions. Let Abacus Data help you move forward with confidence and clarity. Go to abacusdata.ca. That's abacusdata.ca. David, once again, thank you so much for joining us. And there's so much I want to talk about arising from your writing and your life experience and your more recent travels as a Canadian senator. But I wondered if you could tell the story of picking up a hitchhiker on a highway in New Brunswick, which is the foundation of some themes that you've written about. So can you?
Well, I picked up many hitchhikers on many roads and places in New Brunswick. But yes, I picked up a hitchhiker one night years ago, and he had just gotten released from jail, and he was going home to kill his cousin, which I found out about as I was driving him. He was a First Nation kid, didn't have much luck in life, and he felt his cousin had betrayed him desperately. And so he was going home to take care of the matter. And so we had this rather on again, off again, uneasy conversation about the nature of crime and sin and the nature of personal responsibility toward yourself. And of course, it wasn't said in those terms. It wasn't said, expressed in those terms, but it was expressed because of the idea that since the universe is so vast and all the stars were out on that July night, and since the Earth was so tiny, and if you even compare it to our sun, how tiny the Earth is, then what did it matter? We were so insignificant that murder didn't matter. And my question to him was that if murder didn't matter, then why do it? I mean, that was my response to his argument. And so it became although he was very, genuinely nice, I felt that he was determined to do this. And I had no idea what to do about it. But we talked about the nature of sin and the nature of God, because that's what it all boiled down to. And he said he was an atheist because the church had hurt his people. And, I'm sure the church did hurt his people. But you see, it came down to a matter of individual personal responsibility that the both of us were trying to. And finally, I let him out about 15 kilometers from his reserve. and it was a warm night. And I went back home, and I thought, shall I phone the RCMP? And maybe I should phone the RCMP. And then, no, he'll be back in jail, and he just got out. So it was a difficult moment. I did not phone the RCMP, and the murder didn't happen. But I was worried for a while that it would. So it was a very long night for me that night. But you know, I learned something about man's tragic heart, that our battles are always internal. And that no matter where we travel in the universe, our battles will be with ourselves, and they'll be internalized in some way. And that's both a blessing and a curse, I suppose. So I decided to write this essay about it, and then I did.
So you know for sure that he didn't carry out.
Yeah, I do. Murder. I do know that. I do okay. know that because I knew from people who I spoke to who he was, and I know he didn't do it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's later. Not knowing, right?
Yeah. Later on, from what I hear. Because there's a lot of hearsay, but from what I hear, his cousin's house was burned down. And so he might have been implicated in that. Mm. But there was no murder. So anyway.
Yeah. And, you know, what you said, I think, is interesting, because that when you were describing the scope and magnitude of the universe and the insignificance of one life or another, the path that was taking me on was towards the idea of all the stuff in our lives doesn't matter, so therefore don't carry out the murder. But in his mind, it was justification.
Yeah.
You know, so it's interesting how that's a bit of a Rorschach test, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and it's an argument that you see, murder is the greatest act of self-righteousness a man can commit. There's no more self-righteous act than the act of murder. And self-righteousness is totally different from hypocrisy. Because hypocrisy, we know we're doing wrong, but because of weakness or timidity, we commit the act and we know we're being hypocrites. And most of us are hypocrites at certain times. That's the nature of the beast. But self-righteousness bends the very idea of truth to fit your notion of what truth should be. And that's why murder becomes the ultimate act of self-righteousness. You take it upon yourself to play God. Now you might think you do, but you do. And that's why I think and if you want to use the word sin, which I will use here, that's why I think it's a far more devastating sin than hypocrisy.
Hmm. Well, and it's interesting. I wasn't planning to go here, but I know you're a religious person. Is that you believe in God?
It's fair to say I believe in God. Yes.
Yeah.
It's fair to say there are too many things that happened in my life around me and in the history that I've lived so far, not to come to that conclusion. So I've come to that conclusion. I don't ask anyone else to, but that's a conclusion I've come to. Yeah.
Yeah. Fair enough. And what I find interesting is that there are people who are religious. This doesn't apply to everyone, obviously, but there are people who are religious. And to me, I'm not religious, and I don't believe in God. But religion, to me, is in most cases teaches people humility, but often they use it to justify their self-righteousness. Right?
That's one of the great crimes. That's one of the great crimes of religion.
Yeah.
And within all of that, you find, within all of that, you still find little Saint Bernadette and Saint Francis of Assisi. I mean, you still find those glorious people. But yes, that's the problem. False sanctimony creates a horrible self-righteousness that will destroy the world. It creates Torquemada. You know, Torquemada, the Grand Inquisitor. That's who it creates. At the end of it, if you go far enough, that's who it creates. Most of the time, though, it's just belligerent and ignorant. Mm. I wrote in Mercy Among the Children that cruelty and stupidity enter the door hand in hand. And at times I think that's the problem with certain of the religious, but certainly not all of them, but certain of them. Yeah, of course.
So this leads me to, you know, your latest book and much of your writing, which explores moral decisions and morality, right? That's a big theme for you.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? Why are you so drawn to these themes?
Because if you go anywhere, the last person you can leave behind is yourself. And unfortunately, we're stuck with our own values or lack of them, and we have to come to terms with that. No one else can live our lives for us, and we know when we do an unjust act. I mean, there are people who don't care, but most of us, whether we believe in God or not or whatever, we believe that we wish to be decent human beings, and moral decisions are involved in all of that. It is not in the big things where these happen, but it is in the small, intricate things where we sometimes betray others and ourselves that we realize we must do better. And it's as much studying my own life as anyone else's. I mean, all these characters are in some way myself. You can't breathe life into them unless they are in some way yourself. And there's a few of my characters that I didn't like, but most of my characters I do like. Even the criminals, or sometimes more especially the criminals. But at least what I honor most is courage. And maybe it's because I don't have any. But you cannot have moral courage unless you have physical courage. It's almost impossible because you're going to let yourself down and other people down. So I discuss that within the basic tenets of a human life when I write. And so in Tablet magazine, they named me one of the 50 most influential Catholics in the world today, which is very nice of them. And I'm grateful that they would think that, but I am a Catholic, but I'm an unorthodox Catholic. I mean, my whole life has been unorthodox. So I follow no prescribed set of instructions, but I still have a basic idea of what is morally and spiritually right and wrong within the aspect of characters in my novel. Hmm. And I suppose that's what I write about.
Yeah, and I'm curious, do you learn, and do you, for you personally, do you learn about those kind of moral equations or moral decisions as you're writing about them? Or do you start with kind of the framework and your understanding of it at the beginning and then write? Do you know what I mean by that?
Yes, I know exactly. I mean, all my life I found out things from my characters rather than giving my characters things to understand.
Yeah,
and so I mean, I start with a basic tenet of a concept of a novel. For instance, Mercy Among the Children. Lyle is telling a story about his family, but when he tells a story about his family, you have to explore his family. Then you have to explore why these things are happening to his family. So they take over the novel. You know, Tolstoy said in Anna Karenina, he said to his wife, he said, I wonder what Levin is going to do today. Now, Levin, of course, was one of the main characters in his novel, Anna Karenina. And he didn't know what Levin would do because Levin was going to tell him when he wrote it. Well, I felt that about so many of my books and the characters. And that's when you struggle to find out what they're going to do, you know the novel isn't working well. When they tell you what they're doing, the novel works much better.
And then do you learn? I mean, you must feel like you've, by exploring these topics, you've learned a lot about humanity and about human nature and about how we make decisions and what pulls us in different directions.
Yeah, I suppose I do. I suppose it's ingrained in all of us to understand these things anyway. As I said once about the laws of morality when I was being accosted, that there is no real moral, whatever in the world. Code? I said, well, yeah, a code. Okay, thank you. That's good. Yeah. I said, well, we know that to bear a false witness is a horrible thing in New Brunswick. It's also a horrible thing in China. It's a horrible thing in South Africa. It's a horrible thing in Namibia. It's a horrible thing in Australia. To bear false witness is a horrible thing. So don't tell me there's no moral code. Of course there's a moral code. So we all know these things. And within the context of the novel is you're exploring them and how they create great sacrifices or great destruction in life.
And do you feel that those things sort of transcend religion? Because when you were speaking earlier, it struck me that I've always felt, even as someone who's not religious, that when you do harm to others, you're sort of doing as much harm to yourself.
Of course you are.
And whether you believe in the soul and those kinds of things, it doesn't even matter, right? Because you're
No, of course it transcends religion.
Yeah.
Of course it transcends religion. But great spiritual epiphanies always transcend religion. I think there's wonderful things about the Catholic Church, but I also think there's devastating things that it has to admit to. And then it can maybe start to heal itself. But that doesn't mean there aren't great and fine spiritual people within the Catholic Church. So I'm not interested in the plebiscites of religion more than I am in the spiritual context of human beings, and that's another story.
So you mentioned family in the context of your writing. Tell me a little bit about your grandmother, and I gather there was a family movie theater that was.
My grandmother, she was an amazing woman. She, when she was 18, she auditioned for a classical pianist who had arrived from England. And he asked her if she could read music. And she said, no, but I can play anything you can. And she was a self-taught musician, played the violin. She called it the fiddle. She could play anything. And so they started a theater in 1911 in the Miramichi. And he died and left her with three small children. And she continued on with the theater and her opposition, a group of men. First of all, they told her she shouldn't be running the business. She was a woman. And she had three small children. And she fought. She had a war on her hands for 8 or 9 years with these men. They tried to burn her out and blow her up. Foreclose on her mortgage. They tried to do all of that. And in 1928, she heard about this new kind of film, and she went to Montreal and got the monopoly on the talkies and put all the other theaters out of business.
When they were just brand new.
She got the monopoly, and she put the other theaters out of business, and they tried to blow her up with dynamite. Now, when I was in my drinking years, about 1977, I was sitting in a bar and a guy came in and bought me a beer, an old gentleman. And he bought me a beer and he said, "You're Janie's son." And I said, "No, I'm Janie's grandson." And he said, "Oh my God," he said, "time does pass, doesn't it?" I said, "Yes, it does." So he bought me a beer and then he left. And the bartender came over and said, "You know who he is?" I said, "No, no idea." He said, "He was one of the young guys that was hired to blow up your grandmother's theater in 1929. And he'd come in and he bought me a beer to make up for it.
To make amends,
yeah.
Wow.
But she became rather wealthy and very bitter. She didn't have a happy life. But the bank manager who foreclosed on her because he owed a gambling bill to her opposition, and he foreclosed on her. When she left the bank, she said to him, "You can't do this to people. You cannot do this to people." And she went to a lumber baron, and borrowed the money. And it was the first Protestant door. This was sectarian days, right? And it was the first Protestant door she'd ever knocked on. Now, she married a man from the High Church of England, but she was a Catholic girl and she'd never knocked on a Protestant door before. And she said, they're going to close my theater unless I pay off the mortgage. And he said, I'll give you the money, Janie. So he gave her the money. And when she left the bank, she told the bank manager that he couldn't do this to people. In 1952, she was recognized as one of the pioneers of Canadian film. And she was sitting in her office at the Opera House and the phone rang. And it was a woman. And she said, my husband died in the poorhouse in Chatham and I have no money to pay for his funeral. And Janie said, give your husband a decent burial and send the bill to me. It was the bank manager.
Wow.
True story.
So she paid for the bank manager's funeral.
Yes, she did. Yeah.
Even though
yeah,
he had been so awful to her.
Well, he tried to put her out of business. Yeah.
Wow.
So.
Wow. What a story.
Yeah, it's a good story.
Yeah. So, there's so many different themes from what you've written about that I'd love to explore, but you wrote in one of your books about how outrage feeds a famine in people's lives. Can you talk more about that? Because I think there's everything that happens on social media to me is sort of an exaggeration of what was already going on before we had social media.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So tell me more about that, about how outrage feeds a famine.
Well, Lord Byron said, God save us from kings and the mob. And the mob needs to feed on outrage. That's why that is why it is such a pestilence, because it feeds on outrage and it tries to destroy its heroes. The mob will create heroes and then try to destroy them. Every National Enquirer tells you that, you know. Any Hollywood story tells you that. Princess Diana tells you that. So, I mean, and the mob gloats over the destruction of their heroes. I wrote about this in, I think that line comes from The Friends of Meager Fortune. And the heroes that are doing this cut along Good Friday, because of insinuation and rumor, they're all destroyed. And people are gloat over this, over these rumors and these false accusations. They absolutely gloat over them. And when the people are destroyed, they put up statues to them. Because they have maintained the as René Girard says, the great Catholic philosopher René Girard said, and I see Satan fall like lightning. What they have done is they have maintained the status quo by killing the hero and then putting a statue to him. And that's what the mob does. That's what outrage tends to do. Now, it's more subtle and more complex than I'm able to speak about it here, and I can write about it better than I speak about it. But that tends to be why Lord Byron said, God save us from kings and the mob. Or he said, I wish men to be as free from the mob as from kings.
Right.
That's what he said. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And but it's so easy for people to get sucked into that kind of mob mentality, right? And social media is making it even easier. And other
it's making it easier, and it's making it more and more dangerous.
Yeah.
It's making it easier and it's making it more and more dangerous. There won't be a statue that doesn't come down, but what statues will they put up, right?
Yeah.
So you begin to realize what the mob does. And sooner or later, the last thing for the mob to do is to destroy. That's why the mobs are there. So
how is it that as a species, we have the capacity to kind of understand all of this intellectually and yet still fall victim to it emotionally?
God, I'd love to be able to answer that. I don't even.
I
think
thought Freud, you would have the answer.
I don't even know if Freud or Jung could answer that.
Yeah.
But it.
But isn't that sort of our essential? Like, you know, that's our
essential morass. That's the problem. The problem is that we don't often feed the better angels of our nature. But we know the better angels of our nature are the ones that should be fed. Now, in my novel Darkness, Amos Paul talks to Orville McDermott and Mary Sear, and he says, two wolves war in us. One is goodness, kindness, gentleness, and love. The other is envy, malice, anger, and hate. And Orville says, which one wins? And Amos Paul has the answer. He says, the one we feed.
Hmm.
So that's the basic dilemma.
Yeah. So we have a choice about which one we feed, whether we feed the better angels or the darker angels. Basically,
we have a choice of which one we feed. And it's a very hard choice. It's not an easy choice. If it was easy, the world would be a better place. But I remember this young woman who was a student of mine from Germany, writing about how terrible the Nazis were. And she did a play where she had her parents and her grandparents who lived in the age of the Nazis come, and the student put on this play to shame them. And she was telling me about it. And she thought I'd be overjoyed. And I was, you know, not angry, but sad. And I said, my God, darling, you don't know what you would have done in 1933. You have no idea. It was only the very, very strongest people who stood against Hitler in 1933-34. It was only the very strongest. What would we have done? Who knows what we would have done? We don't know.
Yeah, no, we don't. And that's where, you know, I think what you've brought up, which I think is really interesting, is just that how we all sort of succumb to the power of the mob, right? And you spoke earlier about individuality and maintaining your, you know, integrity and not, you know, choosing to do what you want to do instead of what other people want you to do, or write what you want to write instead of what other people expect you to write. Mm-hmm. It strikes me that, you know, individuality is the antidote in a lot of ways to that sort of that mentality kicking in, because otherwise we all just kind of fall into the trap of the mob, right?
Well, the individual is everything or the world is nothing. I wrote in an essay years and years ago, I believe that. I wrote this essay about beauty. And my whole new book, Darkness, is about the search for beauty and false beauty. And it's not an original concept. Dostoevsky wrote one of the great lines in the world about it in The Brothers Karamazov, where he said that the Christ and the devil fight for the souls of man, and the weapon they use is beauty. And how can the devil and Christ use the same weapon? So I wrote an essay about it. And I showed that in 1938, in the second meeting between Hitler and Chamberlain in Dresden, there were on the avenues tons of Nazi flags. There were stormtroopers in their beautiful black helmets with their white gloves and their rifles, and little girls in their traditional dresses were handing out oranges to the entourages, and they lived in a beautiful palace, and the Dresden Lake was blue and wonderful. And it was written about by everyone, by our own Beaverbrook and everyone else's beauty. This was, how could a man like Hitler want anything except peace, because it was so beautiful? In 1941, Leningrad was surrounded. There was no way into the city of death. People were starving. The only way in was Lake Ladoga. And Lake Ladoga, this guy was walking back and forth, waiting for the ice to freeze 6 inches so he could drive his truck across into the city of death. He wanted to get there. and it's a true story. And they told him not to go because the guns were hammering as soon as he got into the city and the ice was mightn't be safe. And he waited, and when he thought it was safe enough, he got in his truck and he went. And what was he bringing? What was his cargo? Oranges for the children for Christmas. So you have Satan's beauty and you have Christ's beauty. Which one do you choose? I think that is a fundamental, one of the great lines that were ever written by Dostoevsky. That's one of the greatest lines in the world. Now, you don't have to believe in Satan or Christ to understand the principle he's saying.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. So how does that play out for you in your writing and in your everyday life? Do you sense that struggle? Because you're obviously more aware of it because you write about it so much. So do you, and now you're a senator, so you're involved in making decisions in parliament.
God, I hope the world isn't relying on me to make them. I'll tell you that. But no, I mean, I'm a writer. I mean, I think of these things, and I think of the beauty of that man driving the truck into Leningrad is worth every splendid thing that ever happened in Dresden and 10 times more.
Yeah.
And I realized that Dostoevsky was totally right.
Yeah.
That's how he was right. Now, Dostoevsky was a lonely, embittered, ill man. He didn't have a great life. But by God, to be able to give us that, you know, not too many people can.
Mm. So. Yeah. That story actually resonates with me because I can remember my dad, who grew up during the Second World War in England. And he, you know, during when the rationing was happening, he would get an orange in his stocking at Christmas time.
Yeah.
And that was a special... That was a special treat, an orange.
Yeah.
One
more story. I know I'm
one more story.
The greatest scene in literature, or one of the greatest scenes, I don't even think it's matched by Tolstoy, although Tolstoy's pretty damn good, was the death of Marmeladov in Crime and Punishment. Marmeladov is run over by a cart on the street. Raskolnikov is on his way to confess to the murder. But he sees Marmeladov, the old drunk on the street, who he brought home before. And he takes him to his house, and the man is dying. And they call for a priest. And so Marmeladov is lying there, dying. His body is crushed, but he's awake and he's looking around. And he looks, and his little girl is sitting in a chair shaking. And she doesn't have she only has a smock on because he took the dress and sold it for booze. He looks, and the little boy has no shoes on because he sold them for booze. And then Sonia comes in. They go get Sonia. She's 17 years old. And she comes in, and she's dressed in this flouncy dress, and she has the star of a prostitute. And that's what his final vision of his family. And I can't think of anything more filled with more pathos and humanity than that scene.
Yeah, that's incredibly powerful. Why does that resonate so much with you?
Because the aspect is not on the child, and it's not on the little girl. And it's not on Sonia. It's on Marmeladov. And your compassion switches from the child and the little girl and Sonia, who's forced to be a prostitute to earn money for her family. And it switches to Marmeladov, the one who they can accuse.
Yeah.
And you realize that he also is a human being. And I think unless you understand that, then not only do you miss Dostoevsky, but you miss so much in life. And I suppose that's why it's so moving. Very hard for me to speak about it, as you can tell. But I do not think, as I told Guy Vanderhaeghe on stage at Harbor Front a few years ago, I don't think there's a greater theme in literature, not from Shakespeare, Tolstoy, or anyone.
Do you think we're in too much of a rush to categorize people as angels and demons, as heroes and monsters?
Because
what you just described,
God.
Right? You don't see the humanity in other people, right?
The horrible idea of scapegoating, the horrible idea of pointing the finger of shame, the horrible idea today of calling people racist at the drop of a hat. It not only is it not right, but it infects the accuser. It's what's so sad about it. It's not that the word racist has become like demon in the witch hunts. It's become the same kind of thing. There's no escaping it. Once you're called a racist, there's no. But the thing about it is, it also infects with malice the person who is saying it. They become the dragons they're fighting against. That's what is so sad. That's what Dostoevsky knew in that scene. That's why your focus shifts from them to the dying Marmeladov, whose wife hauled him by the hair all around the floor 2 days before and called him a monster, and which was rather a funny scene too. But there he is dying, and you realize that not only do the little boy and girl know he's a human being, and Sonia, but we know he's a human being and has to be forgiven.
Yeah, and I think there is a difference between denouncing racism and racist acts and racist behavior and racist language and labeling people as racist, right? And
I think it's a very difficult kettle of fish. I think it's a very problematic. Because whenever I mention this, and I don't mention it a lot, but whenever I do, I'm told, well, there are racists in the world. Well, of course there are. Yeah. And there are bigots in the world. Yes, there are. And there's terrible things that happened. And yes, the idea is that if you start to deny the denouncing of people, then somehow you're complicit in the arrangement of racism and bigotry, which isn't true at all. I don't like the idea of scapegoating others for your own personal or private feelings of gain. I think it's a very dangerous thing. That's all I'm saying.
And yeah, I think that's a great point.
We have to be careful of it.
Because every time you put somebody else down, at least part of it is about raising yourself, right? And that.
Yeah, it's called René Girard, which I just read, as a matter of fact, and I've been dealing with it in my own books for half a century. But René Girard called it victimese, and he called it gaining attention to yourself by showing concern for the victim. And once you do that, once your concern for the victim is to gain for yourself, then you're on a slippery slope. That's the problem.
Yeah.
So,
which again, I want to be clear, nobody is defending racism or
no one is defending like the death. Yeah. No one is defending the death of children at a residential school. No. I'll guarantee you that.
Yeah.
No, sir.
So why did you agree to become a senator? I'm really interested to know how this came about and why, because you've now that this is now become your full-time occupation, preoccupation, job.
Yeah.
It means you have less time for writing.
And I'm sure I'm no good at it. I'm sure I'm a better writer than I am a senator, although I try. I just thought, as Peggy said, you've been talking a blue streak about, things going on in the country. Why aren't you become a senator and do something about it? And I said, they'd never want me as a senator. And so she said, oh, well, why don't you apply? I said, oh, well, they'll never want me as a senator. So anyway, she got the forms and ran them off and said, you apply. And so I did that. And for 8 months, I never heard a thing. And I didn't think that. And then in 2 days, I got a call from the prime minister's office. And then I got a call from the prime minister. And when the prime minister calls, and I mean, no matter what prime minister it is, and he asks you if you want to do something, you say, yes, I want to do something. You know, you say, yes, sir, I'll do it. I think that's an obligatory thing, unless you're going against your nature, which I don't think he'd ever ask. If the prime minister calls on you and asks you to do something, I think we're quite obligated to do it. And it's like, you know, it's like if the queen calls you, you know, and says, will you do that? You don't say, no, ma'am, I'm too busy. You know, you say, absolutely. That's why I'm in a little bit of a funk with Prince Harry, between you and I. You don't say no to your queen, okay? Especially if she's your grandma. But anyway, that's another
story. No, I love it. So, I totally agree with you about that.
So I became a senator, and I'm finding my way through it, and it's not always easy. And I'm some days are better than others, but I'm trying to do as good as I can for the people that I represent, and that's all I can do.
And what have you learned from being a senator?
Well, I've learned the Senate is absolutely essential, and people don't know that. And we know more senators in the States than we know in Canada, and we know more about their Supreme Court than we do about our own. And these things are absolutely essential to Canada. The Senate is a body which, without its function, Parliament would not exist. And we better be very aware of that. And if we take it lightly and we lose them, we lose the Senate, as some people wish, then we're in a real bind. We would have to rewrite the Constitution with Quebec at our heels. And I don't know if we'd want to do that. And I don't know if Quebec would want to do that. The Senate is, as a matter of fact, every Western democracy has a Senate. Because they are actually a chamber of sober second thought. They do go through every bit of legislation. Sometimes the legislation doesn't come as quick as we would want, and sometimes it's rushed through with too many amendments, and sometimes with not enough amendments, but at least we get to study it in committee and vote on it in the Senate to pass it and go back to the other place to get royal assent. Without that, majority government could do anything they wanted. Hmm. And there would be no stopgaps at all. So yeah, I think the Senate is essential. And I think there are very bright people in the Senate. There's some very, very kind, good-hearted, bright people, and they don't always see eye to eye, and they're both on the right and the left, but they're hoping for the best for Canada as they see fit. Mm. So
yeah, I think that people's opinions of the Senate, I think what's happened recently with the appointments like yours of people who are not career politicians and political organizers and partisan individuals, I think that's changed the impression that people have of the Senate. Mm. So I hope that's the case.
Okay.
Yeah. So I just want to pick up on a couple of loose ends from things we talked about earlier. You spoke earlier of selling a 20-year-old vehicle in order to pay the bills and just, rent, people, you've written more than 30 books now. You're a senator. I mean, there's been lots of commentary on the compensation and pensions of senators and that sort of thing. So you're okay now, but obviously people may not realize just how tough it is to be a writer, especially early in your career. Can you describe what those times were like?
Oh yeah. As one biographer of me said, I must've been impossible to live with. Because not only did I disagree with my teachers and my parents and rebel against them, I rebelled against all the people who were rebelling. So they said I must have been impossible to live with. And I don't think it got any better. but I decided when I was in third year university, Well, first of all, I was writing poems in high school and stuff, and I was kicked out of high school because I threw a book at a chemistry teacher. And I threw a book at a chemistry teacher because he found my poems and he started reading them to the class. I can understand I wasn't doing my chemistry, right? I can understand that. And I must have been a pain in the ass to, you know, this little kid writing poems. But anyway, so they took the poem and they took them to the principal. And the principal said, oh my God, he's got to go in front of the school board. You know, he's writing poems. He got in a fight at a dance and knocked a guy down. And now he threw a book at a teacher. Got to go to the school board. So I'm sitting there with my parents and they have the school board people. They're all lined up. And, you know, they're all the stolid members of our community, the storekeepers and the former mayor. And they start passing around my poems. I'm a kid of 17 years old. So they said, David, could you go outside for a minute? So I'm going to sit in a chair. And my parents come out. And they said they think you need to go to a psychiatrist. They think you need to go, there's something wrong with you, and you need to go to a psychiatrist. And my parents were devastated. Of course, they're just, you know, my father worked for a theater. My mother was a housewife. I mean, she's as bright as a whip, but still, these were her friends who were on the school board. They're sending me to a psychiatrist.
Because of the content of the poems?
Because of a variety of things, because behavior, the poems, blah, blah, blah. And I told them that all I wanted to do was be a writer. And at that time I was reading Dostoevsky, and I don't think half the school board heard of Dostoevsky, but that's another matter. Okay.
Yeah.
So, but I just started going with Peg, my wife.
So you met in high school, your wife?
Yeah. So she was going with me for about a month. So I phone her up and say, hi, Peg, how are you? I'm all right. Want to come to Moncton? Why? Oh, I have to see a psychiatrist. They think I'm insane. Do you want to come? Sure. So, you know, if she had said no, we might have been a different life, right?
Yeah.
But she said, sure, I'll go. No problem. So away we went.
Wow.
And we got down to Moncton. I talked to the psychiatrist. Guy just walked back and forth in the room, talked to him. So anyway, he called my parents in. And he said two things. And it's what he said, not what I'm saying. He said, he's brilliant and exceptional. So they were pretty pleased about that. And they drove me home, but I needed to get a strap. So they strapped me. And then they expelled me for the rest of the year so I could come back in the fall. So I wasn't allowed back that. So
they gave you the strap. They hit you with the strap because you threw a book at the teacher.
Well, they gave me the strap after I saw the psychiatrist. And then because the psychiatrist's report was okay, they said you can come back next year.
Yeah.
And I was worried that I was going to be a year behind my friends. But they all flunked. So we were all in the same class the next year anyway.
Because they weren't brilliant and exceptional.
No. Some of them were more brilliant and exceptional than I was. I'll guarantee you that. Most of them were. So anyway, that's what happened there. And
wow, what a story. Yeah.
So years later, the principal was at a reading of mine, and he was overheard telling a friend of his, he was once a student of mine.
This is after you've been published and...
Yeah. So there you go. But what that allowed was a fierce independence about what I was going to do.
Yeah.
And years later, when I became well-known, I guess, I was sitting in Toronto with a group of well-known people. And one was a professor who had gone to Harvard. And he said, I've given my life for Canadian literature. And I thought, so did my wife. She never got to go to Harvard, though. So,
yeah, because that's a, I mean, it's, it says a lot about your wife. That's a big ask, obviously, for her to be in the, you know, to have that life that you had initially where you were, just starting out as a writer and struggling, right?
I mean, you know, my wife was born in very meager conditions. She was, her family, her mother was on a pension, a military pension with 9 children.
Wow.
And then to marry a man who had no future to make any money, had no money and no future to make any. She gave up a lot. You know, there's a scene which doesn't have to do with my wife at all, in Darkness, where the same thing happens to Orville in Darkness. He's sent to a psychiatrist and blah, 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 and he becomes an archaeologist. And years later, the love of his life, the one woman he cared for, who laughed at him, comes back to see him. And she left him when he had nothing, and now he's famous and whatever, and she comes back. And he says to her, you know, you wanted them. You wanted them. I could have given, you know, you didn't know what, why I, you know, you didn't know what I could give you. You wanted them. What he's saying is you've given your life up for others that really didn't do anything for you.
Yeah.
And now you've come back to me now that I'm well known. Well, there's no guarantee I would have ever been well known or anything else. And who knows what will happen to my work anyway. But Peggy didn't do that, you know. And I remember the great story about the great bullfighter in Spain, who they wrote a book, Dominic Lapierre and this other guy. They wrote these, and it was about the great bullfighter, and he asked the girl to marry him, and she wouldn't because her father thought he'd become nothing, that he was nothing but a ragamuffin, and he left, he was kicked out of town, and he became a famous, famous bullfighter, and he came back home, and he asked about her, and they said she lives alone, and she needs a sewing machine because she wants to open up a little sewing shop. So he bought her the sewing machine, but he wouldn't go see her. And this is kind of how Orville feels about this woman, Brenda. And I'm just thankful that it never happened to me with Peg.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, why shouldn't it? Really? I mean,
yeah.
Didn't have a sense, you know. So other people had jobs at the mills and the mines and teachers, and for 5 or 6 years there we didn't have very much. But anyway, so what? We got through.
Yeah.
I wrote my books.
You wrote your books, and here we are.
Yeah.
I think that's a beautiful place to wrap up.
Okay.
This has been such a delight. I'm fascinated by so much of what you shared and the perspectives you have, and it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a great thrill and honor. Thank you very much.
I really, really enjoyed that discussion. It went to so many different places that I wasn't even expecting. And I learned so much from hearing David's perspective on morality, on integrity, on human nature. He's such a great storyteller. And you can really feel his heart in everything that he talks about. And I admire the fact that he's chosen to serve his country as a senator, even though it takes time away from writing. So once again, a big thank you to David Adams Richards for joining us on Digging Deep. If you enjoyed this episode of Digging Deep, please review it and share it with others. That will help us produce more great episodes. And if you want to keep digging deep into topics and lessons like this, or see the show notes for this episode, or subscribe to our weekly newsletter, or read my blog, you can do all of that at letsdigdeep.com. That's letsdigdeep.com. And get ready for more great stories and powerful lessons on the next edition of Digging Deep. Thank you for listening.
Come on a journey like no other, where you will discover many roads that will lead you to a happier, healthier, and more stress-free life. And the beauty is, you don't need any vacation time for this adventure. The journey will come to you. Join Avery Rich on your very own journey into yoga. Along the way, she will demystify yoga poses and guide you into a yoga posture or short sequence, all in less than 15 minutes. You have nothing to lose but stress. The Journey into Yoga podcast. It's not for people who like yoga. It's for people who don't like yoga. Follow or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or at averyrich.com.